High resolution color graphics.
This land of high technology.
The revolution in technology that made the information age possible.
Those kids are not afraid of computers.
Welcome to This Week in Retro for the week of November 2nd, 2020. Coming up on today's show,
a gorgeous new C64 game.
A new mini-ish pinball machine from Arcade 1-Up.
It's pie time. We had a new micro. Pie time.
The King of Kong has his day in court.
All this and more on This Week in Retro.
Up-to-date news
for out-of-date tech.
A game that's caught my attention this week is a work in progress by the name of Wild Wood on the C64. I don't know if you've seen this one yet, John. It was posted on our subreddit and it really does look nice. It's not to be confused with Tanglewood. That was another lovely retro game released in recent years for the Mega Drive. It's got nothing to do with this. Wildwood takes inspiration from the book The Wind in the Willows by Kenneth Graham. It's for the Commodore 64, coming on a 1 megabyte cartridge, disc or digital download. And the first thing that you'll notice when you see this thing is, boy, does it punch above its weight graphically. This game contains arguably some of the best looking graphics in an 8-bit micro game, and I dare say it challenges some of the 16-bit platforms too. You can see some demos of it in motion on the website wildwoodgame.co.uk. The latest update shows a level in which a hare is running through a moonlit field. It really is lovely. It's got multiple layers of parallax scrolling, a really nice soundtrack playing through the SID chip. It just comes together in the rolling demo, because I've only seen a rolling demo so far, really beautifully. What were your first impressions, John, when you saw this?
You know, it's funny. When I saw this, I saw that this was inspired by The Wind in the Willows, and I was expecting, well, a different experience. The Wind in the Willows is one of my favorite books of all time. I love The Wind in the Willows. I actually have a Folio Society edition, a really nice hardback edition with illustrations by Charles Van Sedwick.
Nice.
Just is beautiful. It's probably the most prized book in my entire collection. So maybe that worked against me because I was expecting something more of a pastoral feel. Mm-hmm. If you're familiar with the book, about the first half of the book, I'm pretty sure it's just Mole inside his house doing some spring cleaning. And if you know anything about my love for Animal Crossing, I could go for that anytime, any place on a retro system. So I was hoping for, you know, some gentle rafting on a river. What I wasn't expecting was what I got. Now, I won't disagree that the pixel art is beautiful, but I'm hoping there's more to this than just some simple mechanics with gorgeous pixel art. It kind of reminds me of Agony on the Amiga. You know, it's all flash and just a little bit of substance. However, I know it's very early days yet, and this is just one concept level, so I'm reserving judgment for the time being, and I hope that future levels can capture more of the essence of the book.
Agony is the Psygnosis published Amiga game, isn't it? With the owl.
Correct.
Flying with
correct.
Really
it's
lovely beautiful, animation.
Beautiful owl, beautiful, but it's hard. It's just a shoot 'em up.
Yeah, gameplay is kind of the afterthought, isn't it?
Right.
But I am rooting for this one. I'm not as familiar with The Wind in the Willows as you are. I've read it, but it was a long time ago. Mm-hmm. John Henderson, who is the game's designer here, he's supported by a team of very experienced coders and musicians. And he says, I'll quote him here, he says, "My singular aim is to produce the best looking and most graphically dense game to grace the humble C64, as well as one of the most fun gaming experiences." So he is well on the way to achieving that from the look of the rolling demos. However, like you say, with Agony, there is a vast gulf between creating a great-looking demo and creating a tight, addictive game. But as things stand, I think this is the 8-bit game in development that I'm most excited about to watch at the moment. And I do hope to snag a copy on cartridge when it's released in the summer of 2021.
You know, there are certainly ways to work concepts from the book into the game design. I mean, are you familiar with Mr. Toad's Wild Ride, Neil?
Oh, yes. Slow down, Mr. Toad.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's a very famous Disneyland ride where you're rollicking through Toad Hall in a car. There's all kinds of, you know, action scenes in the book. They take a caravan out on the road. I'd love to see an epic scene where you encounter the Piper at the Gates of Dawn, which for those of you that don't know, that's where the Pink Floyd reference comes from, is from this book. And when you arm up at the end to take down the Stoats in Toad Hall, taxi driver style, I'd love to see that. So there's plenty of opportunities for action in a game like this. I just hope that they can get away from sort of those classic 8-bit tropes as much as they can.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we should really latch too much onto the Wind in the Willows attachment to it. It's good for marketing. It's something people are familiar with, but I think perhaps that's as deep as the connection goes.
Maybe so.
We'll see. We'll see. But we'll keep an eye on things, and you can follow the game's progress at wildwoodgame.co.uk.
Neil, last week during our mini console fatigue talk, you mentioned you wanted a mini pinball machine. Well, I'm sorry to disappoint you. However, if you have a burning desire for a pinball machine that's not quite full size and features multiple tables, we may be able to make something happen for you. Arcade 1UP, the company that constantly releases a steady stream of multi-game arcade favorites housed in a flat-packed three-quarter size cabinet, has just announced their first foray into the world of pinball machines. Now, Neil, I've got two questions for you. Do you own any pinball machines? And how common is pinball ownership in the UK? Back in the olden times, when you were legally allowed to visit your friends, did lots of them have pinball machines knocking about?
How very fitting, because it's the second lockdown starts as of today. So, yeah, not allowed to visit my friends. But no, I don't own a pinball table. And I'd say that owning a pinball table here in the UK is on a par with owning an arcade cabinet, in that they're both niche interests, of course. But for those who are really into them, the holy grail is to own that cabinet or that pinball table, providing you have the space. And space is always the key to these things.
Right.
So I do have a friend who owns both an old Williams Star Wars, I think it's Williams Star Wars pinball table, and then a more modern.
Williams.
It is Williams, is it? Yeah. And then a more modern one based on Episode One. So he's got them side by side in his house, and they're really lovely, lovely things to see in action. He's got a whole room dedicated just to these two tables. So they take up a lot of room. You know, it's very hard to emulate the feel of the bumpers thumping or a metal ball going across the table. It's not just a game of reactions, pinball. It really is a sensory overload that includes leaning forward, gripping the table, peering down into the table, feeling the mechanical parts reverberate through you as you play it. So, you know, I was interested to read up on Arcade 1UP's approach to this problem of emulating that, because this is a digital table, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, and I think that you're absolutely right. Playing a pinball machine is a much more visceral experience than playing an arcade machine, because you are physically gripping the sides of the table in a way, and you can jostle the table physically to get, you know, to make certain results occur. Part, especially of playing old school pinball machines, is they expected you to, you know, work that tilt sensor as far as it can go before you set it off. So it will be interesting to see how they cope with that.
Yeah, yeah. So how common is pinball table ownership where you are, John?
I'd say that pinball ownership is far from common in my neck of the woods, though I do remember visiting at least a couple friends growing up whose parents had pinball machines. These were all electromagnetic type of machines from the 70s with the real scoring, the REEL scoring, you know, the ones where you just have the dials, physical chimes for the sounds. When I moved back from Korea in 2009, I sort of fell in with the local arcade and pinball machine collecting crew. So now it seems like wherever I go, there are always at least a few arcade machines hanging around just in my circle of friends. You might know my co-host on the Amigos podcast, Aaron, and his brother Brent.
Oh yes.
They built a large shed in Aaron's backyard just to house their pinball collection.
So you've got the luxury of space over there in the US. You can just build a pinball house in your garden.
That's right. I mean, you look out, everybody has several acres in their backyard, and you can, you know, you build, some people just build one standing structure per machine. It's an amazing thing. But yeah, it's like anything else. I think once you fall in with a certain group that has a certain hobby, you start to see it everywhere. I'm sure if I got into, say, model railroading or something like that and fell in with that community, it seemed like everywhere I go, there it was. But personally, I got into the game late. All the awesome deals were over by the time I wanted in. I was very, very lucky to get the table that I have here in Amigo Studios. It's a table called Triple Action. It's also an electromechanical game from 1974, and I love it. I love the old school games with the analog sounds without the DMD board, where all the action takes place right there on the table itself.
Triple Action. It makes me think of elevator action. Is that, what's the theme of it? Is that
Triple Action? it's actually a very interesting theme. It takes place on a movie set.
Okay.
And the triple action are the Three Stooges-like characters that are involved in all sorts of antics on the back glass and on the they're in Egypt. They're going in all these different places. And then part of the table is the behind the scenes where you see things going wrong, you know, with sets falling over and stuff like that. So it's a neat theme. It's got a spinner in the middle, which is a unique feature for a pinball machine this old. So when you hit the spinner and it goes around and around, you get triple points if you make the spinner go around all three times. So it's a neat theme. It's a deep table for as old as it is, and I got a fantastic deal on it. So I really hit the big time with that.
Nice, nice. So you've clearly got plenty of hands-on pinball experience then. Tell me then, how does this Arcade 1-Up digital table measure up to your experiences?
Well, this was produced in conjunction with Zen Studios. If you're familiar with video pinball at all on Steam or on Xbox 360 or whatever, they are pretty much the video game pinball studio of record. There used to be an arcade pinball collection that was done by someone else, but they've gone by the wayside and Zen has taken over everything. Lots of pinball purists aren't crazy about the physics in Zen games, but there's no denying that they make entertaining tables. And for the most part, they do a good job with the licenses they receive. This particular table is known as Marvel Pinball, but it includes tables from not only the Marvel collection, but Star Wars Pinball and a collection of classic Williams tables. So you get a lot of bang for your buck with just the standalone unit from Arcade 1-Up. Of course, the playfield is just a screen. You know, it's a television screen. But unlike other video pinball setups that might be, you know, homemade, the plunger is set up with sensors that can detect how far you pull it back. There's haptic feedback from the bumpers and flippers, so you do get some sort of a feel with the haptic response. Neil, when you saw this thing, does it entice you at all as someone with, you know, maybe not as much space as I have, but surely enough space for a pinball machine of some size?
I'm flip-flopping at the moment on as to whether I'm enticed. But on the subject of the haptic feedback on digital tables, I have seen them, and what it really is a fancy word for a hammer, you know. Yeah. In the absence of mechanical parts, because everything is playing out on a monitor, the ball hits a bumper in the game and then it triggers a lump of metal that just smashes into another lump of metal, and it's that simple.
That's it.
It does kind of fool you if done correctly. Mm-hmm. It does kind of work. Does it entice me? What I expressed my desire for last week was a mini digital pinball table. And this isn't it. I'd call this a MIDI pinball table. It's about 3/4 size, as you said. It does still need plenty of space to set up. If I've got space for a 3/4 size, I might as well go all the way and get a full size. I don't know. But being a digital table, the bigger the cabinet, the more expensive the TV is that you need to go in it. So that's where the compromise is being made. Smaller cabinet, cheaper TV, I guess. It makes sense. Does it appeal to me? Comes down to the price. It always comes down to the price, doesn't it? If it's more than a couple of £100, I'd probably be more inclined to build one myself, because I do enjoy the process of figuring these things out and making them myself. Does it include the screens? Is it all pre-configured and ready to go? What's the damage, John?
Yeah, I think that if you are, you know, inclined towards building your own projects, as you are, obviously, this might, you might be better off, you know, rolling your own solution here. But again, for the people that Arcade 1-Up is marketing to, those are not those people. They're catering towards the mass market. They're catering towards people that want to have an instant game room at a lower price point than if they bought in on original machines.
Yeah, and they've proven that to be a successful formula with their cabinets.
Yes, yes. So they haven't announced officially a price yet, but they're pointing towards something in the $500 to $600 range. To me, as long as the components are high quality, I think that's fair. These days, I can't impress upon you enough, if you haven't been checking out prices lately, pinball ownership is a rich man's game. None of these tables were ever produced in great quantities. I mean, I think the Addams Family is the most produced table of all time, and there were still only about 21,000 of those made total worldwide. And when you compare that to, say, arcade machines, which were frequently produced in runs over 100,000, you really see the rarity of these tables and why they command such a high price now. So when you combine that with the inherent fragility of all the mechanical elements and many machines that just sadly went to the scrap heap after they broke, There's a reason why they're so expensive. If you want to go new, a new pinball machine from Stern or Jersey Jack is going to run you anywhere from $5,000 to $9,000, Neil. Ooh. I mean, almost $10,000. We're well into car territory.
No, well into
with,
it, yeah.
With a pinball machine, yeah. And so in any of the classic tables you might remember, like Doctor Who or Star Trek The Next Generation, they're going to be well over $2,000. Even old EM games, like the one that I got for a couple $100, are knocking on a grand these days. Everything is constantly going up in price because people realize that pinball machines are special, you know, because of their mechanical nature, because of all of the craftsmanship that went into the crafting the tables themselves. So if you keep all these things in mind, like I said, $500 to $600 is pretty reasonable. You know, it is a digital table, so you know that you're going to have to deal with that. But once an official price and release date are announced, we may revisit the story in the future.
Yeah, I'd like to do that. I'd like to see the price. And if we go the other way, do you remember there used to be a table, I think it's from the 70s, was it called Colossus? And the goal of that table,
Hercules,
to be the biggest pinball table going. I've actually stood in front of one of those. I've seen one. It is huge.
If you're not familiar with Hercules, it uses a cue ball for a pinball. So that gives you some idea of the scale of the machine. I believe it was made by Atari. And it is something to behold for sure.
A very exciting development this week. It's the release of the Raspberry Pi 400. This latest iteration of the incredibly popular single board computer takes the Raspberry Pi 4 and reworks the design to present it as a compact 80-style microcomputer inside a keyboard. It's like the evolution, if you like, of the wedge computer for the modern day. And honestly, I've got no good reason to be excited about it because it's little more than a collision between a keyboard and a Pi. And, you know, Pis have been around for ages and we all know what they can do. And the Pi 4, the latest iteration, has been around for a while. But I can't tell you why. I'm just excited about it. There's no way this has gone under your radar, I'm sure, John. But for anyone who's missed it, just describe what we're looking at here when we look at the Pi 400.
What you've got here is a wedge-shaped computer, but it's much smaller than your classic wedge, your classic computer wedge. This is not like an Amiga 500. It's not like an Atari 800 XL. It's like a slightly thicker, modern wireless keyboard with all of the ports in the back. It's done up in an attractive Raspberry Pi purple and white color scheme, and it's got a matching mouse with it. I'd say it's very attractive. I like the fact that they put all of the ports on the back because that does give it that classic computer feel. What do you think about the design, Neil?
Yeah, I think you've described it well. Like a wireless keyboard, I've got in front of me a Logitech K400 Plus, which is a very popular wireless keyboard. It looks very much like that without the trackpad attached to it. It's super slim. It's got the nice Raspberry Pi white and purple design. I love it. It's simple. It's functional. It looks like it will be just like typing on a laptop keyboard with really low action keys. And you, like you say, you still get access to the GPIO ports on the rear of the keyboard. So you can do all of the same experiments, the same interfacing with external devices that you can do on a regular Pi. I can see this being a real staple of the classroom, John, you know, or kids' computer coding groups, or even just the bedroom coder who wants to jump onto a platform where you've got a nice, mature, supportive community and tons of tutorials to help you out. It's all out there waiting for you. And of course, it's super cheap. You can pick this thing up.
I really like the fact that it is they've left the GPIO ports open on the back because they could have easily closed those off. And the way that you can have this all in one, I'm just thinking about it from a classroom perspective. Like you said, if you've got a plastic tote, you could basically just pile all these in a tote. And when it's time to play with the computers, you just bring them out and hook them up to the monitors in the lab. Because of the way that modern school applications work, I don't think that they're going to replace the PCs or the Macs in a lab because there's so much specialized software that the Pi may not have. But if you're looking to teach a programming class and you want kids away from all of the distractions that come with a Windows-like environment, this is a great way to just unplug those machines, plug these Pis in, and go to town.
Yeah, if you want to hold a kid's attention on a computer, give them an unfamiliar computer rather than something where they can click around, run command lines that they know and all the rest of it. So, what I like about it is the fact that they've redesigned the board. This isn't just a keyboard case that you put a regular Pi 4 into. You know, they've redesigned the PCB to make it all nicely integrated. It's a nice thing. You can pick it up for £64 on its own or £94 with everything to go with it. That includes a mouse, power supply, HDMI cable, and a really nicely produced beginner's guide to get you started. So under £100 for a 1.8 gigahertz ARM CPU, based, you know, it's got 4 gigabytes of RAM, and it's got a GPU capable of smooth 4K video playback. So, you know, in summary, it's the next Apple Mac, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it.
I don't think you can argue with that package for under £100. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it depends on what you're going for. If you've never had a Pi before, then this is a perfect place to jump in, because the price is not over and above what you'd pay for, you know, a Pi plus all the accessories that you need. Particularly, a lot of people don't realize, you know, when the Pi first came out, they were like, oh, it's a 35-pound computer, but that doesn't include the power supply, it doesn't include the SD card, any peripherals or anything like that. So having it all in one, you know, except for the monitor, but having the mouse and the keyboard and the card and the power supply, everything all together that you only have to buy one package for, and it's attractive, and it doesn't seem like they're raking you over the coals, you know, and upcharges. I think that this is it's a sound investment, especially if you're looking to break into using Linux, if you're using this for any kind of an emulation project, or if you just, you know, like to collect wacky computers like we all do. Personally, though, I've already had 3 or 4 Pis. I've got them. They basically surround me wherever I go. So my next single board computer is probably going to be a Mister. If they could rope a Mister into a similar sized form factor and then theme it like a CPC 464, man, then you're talking. I'd pick one of those up without taking a breath.
Well, the Mister's not that huge. I guess what you're talking about, really what you've described, is the ZX Spectrum Next. You know, that comes at a premium. That's £300 or so. But I know what you're saying. FPGA is the exciting toy at the moment, and the Pi and ARM is in everyone's pocket, so it's not as exciting. And a lot of listeners will have multiple Pis like you do. They'll have tried all different cases out for it. They'll have bought wired and wireless keyboards. They'll, you know, have different hats that they've tried with it. So this doesn't really offer anything new for you and owners like you. But I think from a retro fan's perspective, it does evoke memories of the ZX Spectrum and those low-cost computers of the 80s. Mm-hmm. It's a nice thing to look at. As a tech enthusiast, I think it pretty much removes all barriers of entry for kids to code, as we touched on earlier. The cost is right. It has everything you need with it. And what I think is important is that it's no longer a bare-bones PCB. The original Pi, the point was you could see it. The point was that you could see the PCB and you could plug things into it and you could get comfortable with that. Mm-hmm, but I also think for some people that would have been intimidating for absolute beginners to look at, you know. But this is just a keyboard and everyone understands what a keyboard is. That's not scary at all. So if you're more interested in the coding side and interfacing things in that back GPIO port without being intimidated by bare PCBs, might be a slightly better option. I don't know. I'd like to see how this pans out and if it does make its way into schools. On that subject, you mentioned the computer lab earlier. Is that a thing still in schools? Do you still have dedicated computer labs?
You know, we do. I was thinking the other day about how much longer those are going to be around. But we don't, you know, I teach in a middle school here in the States, and we don't really have a computer programming course, but we do have a digital technology course where students, in theory, learn how to use a computer. Because you would think that these days kids are just immersed in technology. Computer use is second nature to them. Well, it's not. It's never been a bigger lie. Kids are surrounded by phones. They're surrounded by iPads, and they don't know how to save a document. You know, they don't know how to copy and paste. And these are things, you know, before you can get to programming, there are sort of, you know, real world applications for computers that kids, you know, really need to know before they make that jump. I will say that, at least in my school system, a lot of the programming electives are more hardware based. Robotics is a big thing here. You know, aeronautical engineering is a big thing. A lot of students are involved in that. So it's more like using the computer to design hardware applications versus programming software applications. And I'm not really sure why that is, because, you know, I'm a band director, right? I'm not really immersed in that world. But it's difficult for me to encourage, you know, wide scale adoption of any technology just because it goes out of date so quickly. And I really do sympathize with all the districts that have to make those hard, expensive choices about what you can afford to buy and what you can't. But the thing about things like, you know, the Pi, things about Chromebooks is that kids are destructive. That's just by their very nature. Yeah. And machines will break. And if you can order things that are robust, that can be replaced easily, then the students, if things do go wrong, you can get a new unit in their hands, you know, with minimum amount of downtime and minimum amount of cost.
Yeah, just swap out a USB stick from which it boots, right, and then nothing's lost. And you make a great point. You know, kids are so used to phones and tablets, at the risk of sounding like an old man here, kids with their phones, it does it distances them from the way that we had to use computers. When I first used computers at school, you had to program them to get the things to do anything.
Right.
You know, now they're so detached from having to do that. You know, they don't see an operating system even booting up. They don't see anything that exposes them to the underlying operating system or the hardware or anything like that. They're just into the application. If it doesn't work, they go into the app store and uninstall it and press install again.
Mm-hmm. It's a totally different world. Yeah. It's, you know, I liken it all the time to being a car enthusiast, you know, in the 40s and 50s. You know, back then everybody knew how to work on cars. Cars mm-hmm. broke and you fix them. These days when our car breaks, you know, we take it to the dealer and we let them hook it up to the computer and they fix it. It's a totally different thing. And I'm not saying it's better or worse, but technology has moved in a different direction for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a whole other conversation that we can have sometime. But on the subject of the Raspberry Pi, raspberrypi.org is the place to find out more on the new Pi 400. And the This Week in Retro subreddit is the place to share your comments on the story and let us know if you'll be getting one and why. John, we'll just take a break from our stories today to tell you what's on my workbench. I'm working on an Amiga 600, famously filled with plagued leaky capacitors. And it's thanks to our friends at retrobench.com that I have a set of polymer capacitors to put in there. Now, what these do is they replace the electrolytic fluid that you have in wet capacitors with a solid. In this case, it's aluminium or aluminum. So what you get is a dry capacitor and the advantages that come with that. In short, no caps drying out, no electrolytic fluid leaking on the board and destroying it. It's a great upgrade. And I recommend you check out retrobench.com, not just for their capacitor kits, but they've got some other great things on there. Have you seen their Mister setup, John?
Yeah, they've got complete setups in stock. You know, I've been in the market for a Mister for quite a while now. And one of the things that have always sort of perplexed me is, am I getting the right components? Are all these things going to fit together? You have to get boards from different locations. You got to put them together. You got to make sure the case fits. You got to make sure you got the right buttons. Well, on retrobench.com, they've got complete setups right in stock. No more hunting around to find all the parts. You don't have to worry about getting bare PCBs and making sure that you've got the right case for it. They've got the full works in a case with the DE10, the Mister IO board, the extra RAM, everything to just plug and go with a Mister in a single purchase.
And the best thing is they have them in stock. So we'd like to say a special thank you to retrobench.com for supporting today's episode. And do take a moment to check them out.
Neil, it's time for something as close to high courtroom drama as this show will probably ever get. Many of our listeners may be familiar with the film The King of Kong, a documentary that told the story of two titans of Donkey Kong competing against each other for the high score. Neil, did you see The King of Kong when it came out back in 2007?
It was a long time ago, but yes, I do remember watching it. It was all about the battle between Mitchell and Steve Wiebe to get the high score, wasn't it, in Donkey Kong, refereed by Walter Day in his stripy, what is that? Is that a hockey shirt?
I think that's a football, American football referee shirt.
Okay, yeah. Okay. And the thing I remember most about it is that Billy Mitchell doesn't come out of it looking great, does he?
No. You know, in every documentary, you've got to have a villain. And Billy Mitchell played the villain in the story, rightly or wrongly, depending on who you talk to. At the same time, it introduced us to a whole, you know, his whole world, the world of Billy Mitchell, the stars and stripes neckties, the personally branded hot sauce, you know, the whole Billy Mitchell experience. Well, Neil, Mr. Mitchell is in the news again, and I'm not just referring to his professional wrestling debut a few weeks ago on AEW.
Are you for real?
I'm for real. Oh, he does it all, man. He does it all. Now, in case you're not tapped into the world of 40-year-old gaming world records, let me catch you up on the story so far. So Twin Galaxies, since its inception in the early 80s, has been the self-appointed governing body in publishing high scores, particularly on classic arcade machines. At some point in time or another, Billy Mitchell held legitimate records in at least a dozen machines. These were actual records he set in the 80s during events on real machines, so there should be no question that we're talking about a skilled games player. However, in 2018, Twin Galaxies decided to invalidate every single one of Billy's high scores due to video evidence that some of his scores were not achieved on actual arcade PCBs. This is significant because, again, all of his high scores were invalidated, not just the ones that have been shown to be erroneous because of the format they were submitted in. So this is a, to compare it to baseball, this is like when, you know, Pete Rose was stripped of all his glory because it was found out that he bet on baseball. Man, I'm just going to cut that out because nobody cares about baseball. This is significant because, again, all of his high scores were invalidated, not just the ones that have been shown to be erroneous because of the format they were submitted in. So, you may ask yourself, is this a suable offense? Well, Neil, this is America. Everything's a suable offense. Mitchell is suing the Twin Galaxies organization because of defamation of character. Billy has built his career on his ability to play video games well and sees Twin Galaxies as, you know, having this malice against him because presumably, you know, they think he's a jerk. So anyway, Twin Galaxies countered legally and tried to block the lawsuit from coming to pass, but it's been granted the right to proceed by a judge. Though if Twin Galaxies should win, Mitchell is expected to pay upwards of $80,000 in legal fees. Now, Neil, what do you think about all this? Have you looked at the video evidence? Have you looked at the Zapruder film of Donkey Kong that kicked all this off?
Well, I'm not the one, I'm not one to pass judgment on someone without being in full possession of the facts, of course, John.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But if you want to caricature what a bad guy should look like in the world of esports, as we call it now, of course, we didn't call it back then, Billy Mitchell he's exactly what you would draw as an esports mm-hmm. bad guy. He's the Dick yeah. Dastardly, the pantomime villain. And I always thought that he played that role well and used it to his advantage. It's great for marketing, you know?
Right.
But I always assumed that when the cameras were turned off, that Billy took off his Stars and Stripes tie, took off the makeup, maybe even removed the wig, and had, you know, had a cold beer with Walter Day. And maybe that was the case, but there's clearly no love lost between them now, I think. My understanding is that this specific problem is it revolves around Mitchell's use of MAME, the emulator, to record his scores while claiming that they were recorded on a real cabinet. And because of the difference between how a real cabinet updates the screen and how the MAME emulator does, if you slow down that footage, you can prove that the emulator was used. And there are other technical discrepancies that are... I think it's been comprehensively proved, really, hasn't it, in the videos?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. I don't think there's any way that you can look at what's been submitted and say, no, that's absolutely false.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, one real tell is there's this thing called girder finger, where one of the girders in the game develops like a finger-like row of pixels on one end in MAME, and that never happens in the real hardware. So
yeah,
there's no doubt about it. And Mitchell's response to these claims was just to double down and declare that the evidence had been tampered with, that the videos had been swapped out. They were fake videos, fake news, you know, gaslighting, all the rest of it. The guy should be a politician.
He should be running for president.
Well, let's not go there. That's a dangerous place to go this week. But I think if you watch the video evidence, there's no denying it. And there's so much more to support this. There's another video where Mitchell staged an arcade machine technician swapping out the Donkey Kong PCB board from the cabinet that he set the record on, supposedly, because he wanted to swap it out and put a Donkey Kong Jr. board in. That was his video evidence that it was a real board, until someone pointed out that in that very video, the board being taken out was a Donkey Kong Jr. arcade board being swapped for the same things.
A little bit shady dealings there.
Impossible. So, unless something miraculous happens in court to prove he's completely innocent, then my conclusion is that the man is a complete sociopath. He's no longer marketable as the bad guy of retro esports who everyone loves to hate. He's just become the guy that everyone hates to hate, if mm-hmm. this is proven. And my prediction is that he'll declare that he's had an epiphany at some point. He'll want to keep himself relevant somehow. So maybe he'll do like a reality TV show or something about his recovery from video game addiction and how it made him a bad person and all of this stuff. That's I'll put $10 on that with you, John. His own reality TV show. What do you think about it?
Yeah, I see no reason to think that this wasn't a fabrication on the part of Billy Mitchell to stay on top of things. Yeah. As long as he's number one, I'm sure the amount of public appearances along with speaker fees are much higher than if he was three or four in the world. To me, and I'm speaking as someone with no actual knowledge here, this sounds like a Lance Armstrong type deal where you've got a guy with a lot of natural talent. Nobody can deny that this guy is just a beast of classic gaming. I mean, the amount of records that he's held in the past, undisputed records, is very, very impressive. But, you know, this is a guy with a lot of natural talent that knows he's losing ground to younger competition, and he's willing to bend or break the rules to keep his edge.
Yeah, I don't doubt for a minute that he's a very, very talented video game player. But yeah, he needs to let go. He needs to just enjoy the circuit, you know, not try to crush the new generation through alleged cheating. Just enjoy it, you know, whether he's third, fourth, or fifth. People will recognize him. He's enough of a personality and a character to do well regardless. Right. Do we know when this case is actually going to court?
It's going to be a while until this is resolved. It looks like the trial schedule isn't even going to be set until December, so it'll be 2021 before we see any action. I'm hoping that it's all live streamed on Twitch, of course, with esports commentary. As Mad Max 559 said in the comments section of this story on Ars Technica, the barrels of justice move slowly but surely.
So thank you for listening to This Week in Retro. Join our show subreddit and contribute your favorite stories from the world of retro.
Help us spread the word about the show by leaving us a review on your podcast app of choice, sharing our Facebook page, or just telling a retro-loving friend. See you next week for more up-to-date news
for out-of-date tech.